This is a recording of Noah Merrill on draft resistance, conscientious objection, and the poverty draft. He spoke at the Quaker Meeting House in Storrs, Connecticut on November 11, 2004. This is the first of a two-part recording. With the war in Iraq grinding on and the U.S. military preventing people from leaving the service, many young people in the United States have been watching out for a military draft. The legislative situation is ever-changing, but there are many ways to prepare for that possibility, and the first step is to keep informed. Noah Merrill is the program coordinator of the Southeastern New England American Friends Service Committee, or AFSC. He has a degree in cross-cultural conflict transformation from Indiana University. He has also served as a trainer in nonviolent direct action, as an AmeriCorps team leader working with inner-city communities addressing issues of violence, and as a human rights observer in the indigenous Mayan communities of Chiapas State, Mexico. Noah Merrill and the AFSC in southeastern New England conduct trainings in counter-recruitment, draft and enlistment counseling, and alternatives to military service and militarism, and these were the topics presented at this event. It should be noted for those of you from outside the area that the Meeting House in Storrs is right near the main campus of the University of Connecticut system. Like Storrs and its surrounding town of Mansfield, nearly all the people in attendance that evening were white and middle class, two demographic details that will factor into the discussion. Noah Merrill was introduced by Shoshana Levinson.
Welcome. It's so nice to see so many people coming out for information. I mean, this is what moved me, was the fact that I wanted information. And I didn't want to get it from the internet, from sources that I wasn't sure about. And so what I did was I turned to the American Friends Service Committee and I called their Cambridge office, which is for all of the Northeast. And I told them, this was 2 months before the election, and I said, I want to know what's going on with this potential draft. I have a son that is of draft age, and I want information, and I really felt pulled to do something about what I got. Well, I was given Noah Merrill's name. Noah lives in Providence. He has a degree in cross-cultural conflict transformation from, is it the University of Illinois?
Indiana University.
He works for the American Friends Service Committee. He does trainings all over the Northeast. And I think that's enough information for me. Let's find out what Noah has to say so we can learn.
Thanks, Shoshana. As she mentioned, my name is Noah Merrill. Officially, I'm program coordinator for the American Friends Service Committee in southeastern New England, which means I'm kind of out of place tonight. Technically, my area of responsibility is a tiny portion of eastern Connecticut, Rhode Island, and eastern Massachusetts, excluding the Boston metropolitan area. So I spend most of my time in Cape Cod and Rhode Island and Providence, Fall River, New Bedford, that area. But it's a joy to be with all of you tonight. And I would say that it's a joy to be here because, sadly, our Connecticut program coordinator, Marsha Morris, has, as many of you may know, has had to relocate to Boston. And currently there's a search going on for a new person to come and be the program coordinator in Connecticut. So hopefully there will be a new face joining all of you to help educate and activate around these issues of war and militarism in the future. So as Shoshana said, I work for the American Friends Service Committee. What does this mean? Well, the American Friends Service Committee is a Quaker-based organization that includes people of all faiths who are committed to nonviolence and social justice. What does that mean? It means that we're based in the Quaker belief that there is that of God in every person, which basically means that we believe in the inherent dignity and value of all people. And we also believe in the transformative power of revolutionary love. Which is something it's something of an article of faith for me. So it's very much something that motivates me, and I think many of the people here may be motivated by those same leadings. So that's what brings us to find ourselves compelled to speak out on issues of conscience, especially when it relates to violence, and when it relates to organized violence on the scale that we see in warfare. This is the most catastrophic, the most destructive form of violence that humanity has invented. So from a Quaker perspective, and I'm speaking both from an activist's perspective and from a Quaker perspective tonight, the decisions that we make about war, our involvement in war, and our witness related to war in society are some of the most important decisions that we can make. And I hope that there are other people here who share that belief. If you don't, though, you're welcome. And I hope that that we have a chance to discuss these issues, to learn from each other tonight, and to, and most importantly, to learn about the situation as it affects us related to the draft, related to conscientious objection, and what that is for those folks who aren't aware, and related to something called counter-recruitment and recruitment, military recruitment. And we're going to talk a little bit about that. So I want to go over an agenda really quickly, and then let's get started. I would call this an introduction. We're going to do a little bit more of an introduction with a few of the people who are here in just a second. Then we're going to talk about the state of the draft right now. We're going to talk about military recruitment and what that is and what that's about, how it functions, what its supposed role is, what role it plays. Conscientious objection, what that looks like, the history of that, and what it looks like in the future. Counseling related to enlistment and military service. And then counter-recruitment, what we talk about when we talk about counter-recruitment. And hopefully, as we go through this, if anyone has a quick question, if I use a word you don't understand, or if there's something that can be resolved quickly, I'd like you to please raise your hand and I'll call on you. If it's a longer question, let's wait until the end and we'll do some question and answer. Is that acceptable to everyone? Fabulous. Okay. So the introduction, I'd just like to get a sense from some of the folks who are here. I imagine some of you are here for a number of different reasons, but I'd like to get a sense of why. Just a few of you are here. Folks who wouldn't mind sharing that with the group would just raise your hand.
Yes.
I have two sons, and I'm against the war.
So it seems like that's a really, really natural fear. We don't want an issue like military service to hurt those who we love. Absolutely. Thank you for being here. Yes, sir.
I have two sons. One is 18, and the other is approaching 18. And I was a conscientious objector, classified 1AO during the Vietnam era, and was drafted and served in the military as a medic.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for being here.
Anyone else? Any other reasons for being here?
Yeah, I'm Pete Andrehagen from Northwest Community Peace Action, and we're planning to do counseling in the high schools. Mm. And so I'm just picking up whatever organized information you have.
Great. So there are some people who are here out of personal concerns. People are here because of their activist work. Are there any other people who have other reasons for being here? Yes.
I'm a high school social studies teacher, and I've always done activist work around the military and the draft, but especially now I want to make sure that I'm up to date on information so I can share that with my students.
Thank you for being here. It's important that students get access to a wide variety of perspectives, I think. So I'm glad to see that. I understood as I was coming in, there are some members of the media here who are here to cover this event for other reasons. Could those people just raise their hands just so we know who they are? Okay. And I want to say, just out of respect for folks who are here, that because we welcome members of the media, I would just urge people that if they want to share personal stories, that to recognize that this is being done in a public environment. So please keep that in mind as we have this discussion. Okay. So when we're talking about the draft, the burning question that I've been doing these draft counseling trainings, a whole chunk of these, probably the last 6 months or so, an enormous number of people, it seems like, are calling and they're really interested in having these counseling sessions. And the burning question on everyone's mind, of course, was related, I think, partly to the fact that there are a couple of wars going on, and partly to the fact that there was this email, or a number of different emails that were circulating on the internet like wildfire, going around talking about this new draft bill that had been introduced. And at the American Friends Service Committee, we found ourselves going around to different communities. In many ways, we started to feel like we were trying to sort of work damage control to keep this information from spreading, because some of this is reason to be concerned and some of it's not. So what I'd like to do is just to get this out of the way at the beginning. I'd like to read you just the opening paragraph from an email that I got from an organization called the National Center on Conscience and War in Washington, D.C. It's entitled H.R. 163, Overwhelming Defeat, October 6, 2004. H.R. 163, which was introduced by Charles Rangel, Democrat of New York, and which would have reinstated the military draft, was voted on in the House of Representatives yesterday. The bill was overwhelmingly defeated with a vote of 402-2. Okay. So there were only two people, both of whom were Democrats, who decided that they thought it was a good idea for us to have a draft. So what's the backstory? I'm sure many folks know this. The backstory is that a group of Democratic representatives decided that they were going to try to raise awareness about something called the poverty draft. And we'll get to what that is in a second. They wanted to draw attention to the current state of the military. So they thought, well, we'll put up a bill to see if people get drafted, and then we'll watch all the people who don't want their kids to be drafted say, no, 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 don't do this. And then they would be able to point out that the people who serve in our military are overwhelmingly poor, are disproportionately people of color, and are disproportionately people with a low level of educational opportunity. Okay, so that's what we mean when we talk about the poverty draft. We talk about people who come from backgrounds they don't have access to higher education, where they're not given the kind of encouragement that they might or education that they might need in order to be able to excel academically, where they don't come from backgrounds with families that have substantial resources, and generally they come from populations which are out of the mainstream, which could include rural white agricultural populations that maybe haven't benefited as much from you know, recent changes in the economy as some other people who live in cities and have more education. So that's what we mean about the poverty draft. And these guys thought this was a really good idea. Several people several groups which work on this issue have made it very clear to them that this is not a good idea, that there are an enormous number of us who don't appreciate people playing around with the draft, recognizing that it's very dangerous to propose a draft. You never know who's going to back it. But the bottom line on this is they did this. They certainly got a lot of attention generated. They voted against their own bill. And it's been an overwhelming proof to the country that there's absolutely no support for this, except for these two guys, and nobody really knows what's going on with them. But 402 people, 402 of our elected representatives decided it was not a good idea at all. The story with this is also that since Democrats proposed this initiative, Republicans wanted to call the question so that it would not be an election year issue. They were concerned that it would be an election year issue, that fear of the draft would swing the election to John Kerry. Clearly that didn't happen. But that was part of the thinking in that. So that's where we are with the draft. Okay? There is currently no legislation that is active that is proposing reinstatement of a draft. Okay? What we're left with is the Selective Service Administration, which is implemented as part of what people call the peacetime draft. This was implemented in the early 80s. As a means of preparing for a draft, should there need to be a call-up for a draft. Now, it's important to stress that this is different from a draft in a time of war. Okay? The president has a constitutional right to draft people in a time of war. But since there hasn't been a formal war declared for quite some time, the Selective Service Administration, right, is created so that we could call up people when we weren't officially in a declared state of war. So it's important to note that if we ever were to actually declare war on somebody, the whole ballgame would change, and everything I'm going to tell you tonight would probably not be relevant, at least the first part of this, because there's a constitutional right for the president to conscript people. Now, what would happen, what kind of opposition there would be in the event that there was a war, that's up for us to talk about in our own smaller groups. But what I'm going to talk about is the situation as we see it now. That changes, again, I want to emphasize that again, that changes if we actually do declare war on somebody, but that hasn't happened since. Anybody tell me? Last time? Okay, the last time that we actually declared war on someone, 1941. So other times we've had all kinds of police actions, we've had all kinds of interventions, we've had all kinds of things like Iraq, for example, which we don't officially call a war. If there were to be a draft, and this is important, if there were to be a draft, the first thing that needs to happen is that legislation has to be introduced, okay? And that has to be passed by both the Senate and the House of Representatives. So this is not something that's going to happen overnight, okay? And this has to be confirmed by the president. Generally, what would need to happen is the president would actually have to ask for a draft. So the president, whoever that person might be, in this case, George W. Bush, would have to ask Congress to instate a draft. Then both houses of Congress would have to approve a draft. There would be debate. There would be all these, you know, all the things that normally go into the legislative process. And then there could be a draft. Only then would the Selective Service Administration, which is not a part of the Department of Defense, it's a civilian administration, the Selective Service Administration would be instructed to begin calling people up. Yes?
Quick question.
Yes.
So if we're in a declared state of war, the president doesn't have to go through Congress at all?
If we're in a declared state of war, the president has the right to do that.
Without?
To the best of my understanding, yes.
Okay, without getting the House and the Senate behind him.
But Congress has to declare war. Good point.
Right.
So we can't go to war officially unless Congress declares war. But once that's happened, the president has that power to exercise. Okay. So there's still a check and balance there, at least as people might see it. At least constitutionally, there's a check and balance. So once the Selective Service Administration began calling people up, what would happen is that people would, as a part of the lottery, the draft lottery, people would be assigned numbers in the draft, and then they would be instructed to report to the draft board. Okay, as they did that, there would then become an opportunity for people to appeal, if they wanted to do that, to appeal the classification they were given. And I won't go through it tonight. I don't think we have enough time. I won't go through all the various classifications. The point is, some of the classifications require you to be called up immediately. Some of them, you're called up a little later. And some of them, you're not eligible for service, whether it's a physical handicap or a mental handicap or just because of something like not believing in war. One question people have asked is there an exemption for conscientious objection if there were to be a draft? If there were to, you know, if the Selective Service were to be activated and we were to be drafted, would there be an exemption for conscientious objection? And the answer to that is, unfortunately, that we don't know. And the reason that we don't know is that the law hasn't actually been drafted yet. The law that was drafted this last time said a number of things about that. It said that you had a 10-day window of opportunity in which to apply, and everybody was extremely concerned, I think rightly, that 10 days between the time when they order the draft and the time when you have to report is not long enough time for everybody all over the country to get in their conscientious objector claims. The fact is, without belaboring the point, that we really don't know what the provisions of a draft will be. If they were to write a new bill, it might very well be that women would not be exempted. It seems rather unconstitutional that women would be exempted in this day and age. I think the bill could be challenged constitutionally if women were exempted, because this is about equal rights. So we don't know what exemptions there would be, and we don't know the terms on which people would be called up. We don't even know the term of service they'd have to serve. So that's really up in the air. The important thing that I want everybody to get out of this is the time to fight a draft is not once they institute legislation. The time to fight a draft is right now. It's to make it clear to our Congress people, those people who are elected to represent all of us in this country, that the water is very, very chilly for a draft. So as long as we continue to make that clear, and as long as we take action to ensure the United States does not get involved in a formal state of war, we should be okay. We should be able to rest fairly easy. Although, you know, constant vigilance, to quote a character in a Harry Potter novel, constant vigilance is always important. Okay. So, military recruitment. Can you raise your hand if you have ever had an interaction with a military recruiter? Those people who raised your hands, would you give just a brief, like a little one-sentence description of your experience? I saw a hand over here.
I was just at school and someone came up to me in the hallway.
You were at school. Is this a college or a high school?
High school.
A high school. Okay. And someone walked up to you and
army person and tried to tell me why I should join or what the opportunities are.
Okay. And so this was a man or a woman?
A man.
A man who was. How was he dressed?
I don't remember.
Okay. Was he wearing a military uniform?
I don't think so.
Okay. Okay. Anyone else? Other experiences? Interactions with military recruiters? I saw a hand up here, this gentleman.
Yeah, they come to my school periodically, and I was wondering, what was the rhyme and reason to when they came, like, if they have a certain schedule. So I asked him, and right away he asked me if I wanted to go on a bunch of lists, and he gave me his card and stuff, and I was like, no, thank you, but, so.
What did he reply when you asked him about the schedule?
He says it comes by invitation, so I asked the guidance office, shortly thereafter, and they told me that, you know, they told me that they come at their own whim, so it's just sort of like kind of discrepancy, you know. So, and you never know who's coming. Like, I think the Air Force Community College comes a few times. I go to Talent High School, so that's a very like kind of rich population, so it's not very frequented. Mm-hmm. But like there's the Army, the Air Force, and they all make hits to our school, you know, once every 2 months or so. Mm-hmm.
So people who talk about that, you mentioned an important point. People who talk about the poverty draft will point out, if you look at the statistics when they're collected, of visits by Army recruiters, there's a huge weight on the scale statistically between, you know, between the schools that have generally wealthy populations and the schools that have generally poor populations. The poorer populations, the poorer schools, the less funded schools are vastly more likely to have visits by military recruiters across the country, regardless of demographics, except that in inner cities, in populations that are largely populations of color, you get a lot more visits from military recruiters as well. Fairness in description. People will say, military recruiters who I've spoken to will say, the reason that military recruiters go to these schools where people don't make a lot of money is that they are providing an option to these kids who don't have another option. They're providing a way to pay for college. They're providing a way for people to make something of their lives, to straighten themselves out if they've got problems in their lives. This is the argument that people will make. Okay? So, and the decision, and I want to be clear here, the decision about these things really has to come down to conscience. It's not about me taking my ideology and forcing it on anyone else. It's about us making it clear that I am speaking from my beliefs, from my conscience. If people want to take advantage of those options, you know, God bless them. That's great. That's their choice. That's not my choice, and I think it's not the choice of some of the people in the room. The point is that what we're talking about here, addressing all of these issues, is being educated to make decisions based on conscience. So I just want to say that for any folks who may think the military recruitment is a good idea who are in the room, I think that's important people hear that. So military recruiters overwhelmingly target schools with generally low income in terms of the families that these kids are coming from, populations of color, and rural white populations. Military recruitment is a job. Okay, military recruitment is a service, right? It's a means of service in the military. So these people who are recruiters, they aren't sort of some other classification. They're actually on duty in the military. It's a pretty good job if you can get it. And you imagine serving in the military. Military recruiters generally get a lot of perks. You're given a car. Often it's a nice car because they want to make sure that military recruiters are driving around in nice looking cars so they can be appealing to people. Generally, you get, you know, you spend a lot of time in uniform, you get a lot of respect in places where you go. And you get paid pretty well, frankly. You have a mission. Outside of the military, we call that a quota. This is the number of people that you have to recruit in a given term. Often that's in a given month. So this is like a salesperson. You have to get this many sales, or you lose your job, or you may be reassigned, maybe passed over for promotion. So the important thing is that people who are doing this because it's their service in the military. They're not doing it because they like educating young people. They're doing it because their job is to recruit people and get them into the military. And it really means get people into the military whether they want to go there or not. Military recruiters are very friendly. They're very often very well-spoken. They're often very, very admirable people in terms of being, you know, stand-up guys, usually guys. They're very generally they pick more attractive people to be recruiters. This is not a joke. People who are less attractive are actually, you know, not very likely to be recruiters because you want to, you know, somebody who's a good example of you know what service in the military can do. And often these people are people who have stories of sort of turning their lives around through the military. That's important. Any of you who have seen a movie called Fahrenheit 9/11 would take issue with some of the things presented in that movie, but one of the things that I would say is very, very true is the way that military recruiters behave. The film of military recruiters, that's very, very much like what my experiences have been, both as a high school student and as an adult doing this work. That's how military recruiters behave, for better or for worse. Military recruiters, there is a huge budget for military recruitment. That budget was just increased drastically. The exact numbers are sort of a matter of debate, so I'm not going to throw out numbers for those people who are going to count. But suffice to say that the budget for military recruitment is vastly higher than the budget for, say, preparing people for college in terms of after school programs, tutoring, et cetera. Military recruitment is also an industry. So recently, military recruitment has expanded into a variety of areas in our society. Military recruitment, for those of you who have children who like video games, every manufacturer of video games, except for Sony, also makes games for the military. So this new game that's just come out, Halo, that people are very familiar with, these different games, all of these do double duty. They can sort of be reprogrammed. Instead of running around in an alien spacesuit, you're running around in fatigue. It's not very difficult to do. And these are used both within the Army as training simulators and also as means of recruiting young people. I want to tell you about something, just an example of what I'm talking about. With a big budget, you can hire marketing people. And when you hire marketing people, you get something like military adventure vans. Raise your hand if anybody has ever seen a military adventure van. Okay. City colleges, particularly commuter colleges, community colleges, places where the population is, this is higher education, but it's not necessarily the most prestigious of higher education. These are the kind of schools, like regional campuses of universities, that kind of thing. They get these things a lot. What'll happen is a huge semi-trailer will pull up, generally pulled by a big truck with something like Air Force written on the side of it. Right, and they'll pull up, and they've got inside this thing, they have this whole simulator thing. I actually had a chance to visit one of them about a year and a half ago. So you'd walk up some steps, you'd tell the person dressed in an Air Force uniform, they tell them your name, you'd walk in, and you'd sit down at essentially a combat simulator, right? Where you would be dropping bombs, just like a video game. You put your face up against these little goggles, and you drop some bombs. And it's the beautiful rendered kind of virtual reality screen. You're dropping these bombs, you're watching these explosions go off. It's just like, the highest end video games. On your way out, you receive a printout which has your name, Air Force, and the number of kills. Okay? You get a score. Because you're doing, this is the exciting video game that you're learning to play. And of course, once you've done that, they ask for a lot of information and then they send you information about the Air Force. These are the kind of things that people who are interested in presenting alternatives are dealing with. These incredibly well-funded folks who are incredibly well-trained are all over the country recruiting every day because it's a full-time job, and they're winning. They're recruiting an enormous number of people. It's a very effective system. So, on that note, military recruitment.
No, I just want to say before you go on and leave recruitment, probably everyone should know, and you probably do know, that the Patriot Act has made it easier for recruitment to happen because it requires high schools to give recruiters the names of all seniors. And only if the parent writes a letter can they requesting refusal. Do they not get those names?
I appreciate you bringing that up. I was actually planning on looking at that when we started to talk about counter-recruitment, but since it's brought up, I'll mention it. We may have had different information here. My understanding is that one of the provisions of the No Child Left Behind Act is that schools are required to provide military recruiters with the full information that they have on any given student. This can be a disciplinary record, this can be grades, this can be comments of teachers, this can even include medical histories, of the information that recruiters receive from the schools. And again, the only way to prevent this is for the parents to sign a waiver saying that they do not want their children to have this given. So it's assumed consent. Now there is some debate about whether or not the schools are required to inform the parents that there's a waiver. Technically, the law says that they do have to inform the parents that there's a waiver, although the overwhelming policy across the country has been they don't inform the parents. And since most of the parents don't even know this provision exists, parents don't get upset about it. I saw a lot of hands, so let me...
Could you say that all over again?
The No Child Left Behind Act, right, which is designed to be a, a, a piece of legislation, we've heard a lot about it, and it does a lot of things, it's a big thing, to enforce accountability and improve standards across the board nationally in this country. A lot of people have taken issue with it for a number of different reasons. But the important point for us to look at right here is that under the argument for this is that young people should have access to every opportunity that they could, right? So wouldn't you think if a kid didn't have an option to go to college, if a kid didn't have an option to learn a skilled trade, that they should have the option to go in the military and then they get money for college and they might have, you know, health care and they might have an honorable career? That's the thinking. That's the argument at any rate. So in order to facilitate that, the law includes language which requires schools, secondary schools, high schools, to give the information on all of their students, right, to the Military Recruiters Network, to make this information available. The military recruiters can then just look through it and say, oh, there's a kid whose life has gone downhill. He used to be getting B's, now he's getting D's. Let's see if we can straighten this kid out. Let's bring him into the military. Let's recruit him. That's an example of what could be done there. And the requirement is that in order for that to be prevented, a parent has to sign a waiver saying, I do not consent for my child to have this information turned over to the military. Yes, sir?
Is that only to the military, or is it the corporate world, too, have access to that?
My understanding is the language that I have seen refers to the military.
The understanding that I had was that if you said to parents, would you like your child removed from this list, in theory, that meant that they were removed from all lists that might go out to any other places.
Meaning, I'm sorry, which list?
Meaning that once you're off the military list, you're not on anything else either.
Mm.
Some people think. I'm just putting that out there.
My understanding is that the waiver, the information that I have, again, and it's maybe just limited, the information
that
I have.
It says military recruiters. Doesn't say anything else. This says military recruiters.
That's a copy of the waiver?
Yeah.
So, but that you may be correct. I don't actually know if that removes that whole thing. Yes.
I don't know all the facts about it, but I think it might vary in terms of how schools deal with it, because I know that in Mansfield, for those of you who are parents of Mansfield students, at our high school, they sent out a notice with a whole bunch of, you know, papers that get sent out to parents that this is what's happening. If you don't want the name given to the military people, you have to sign this waiver. And a lot of people missed it. So some students put together a little protest to say we want to make sure people know about this. And our administration was very receptive to that. And they sent out another notice to parents. And they also said that they had forms, the waiver forms, right on the desk at the office, and said students could come down and sign them themselves. And if students sign those, they will not give out the information. And I don't know if that was legal, but that's what they said, because they didn't really want to give out the information, I think.
This raises an important point. One of the great things that we still have in this country is that we have, and people may dispute this, but one of the things that works both ways is that we have fairly local control of school systems, and this is important. It's important for people who are on the more conservative end of politics, and it's important for people who are on the more liberal end of politics. I think local groups of parents and teachers and concerned people in the community really can pressure their principals and their school boards and these groups to make sure that they do this. And that sounds like there's a school board that's really been observing its obligations. There are certainly a lot of school boards that don't do that, that have very different feelings about this. But I think that's important, is to say by and large, the rule has been that people have not observed that. There are certainly a lot of parents, community activists that are getting on top of this, and this is happening.
I have two comments. My understanding was that school districts could refuse to give the names over, but they would lose funding. The second was that I actually got a waiver home. Our school sent one in the mail to every parent, and you could sign it, but they made it really clear that if you did, you wouldn't get any college information either. So I have a son that's a senior that's getting all this stuff in the mail, but... And that's why I didn't sign it. It was a tough decision.
These are dealing with the bureaucracy of these things is a very, very complex issue. And it's a reason why people need to be more educated. People need to get these resources. I have a number of resources that I've brought that hopefully can be distributed, and I can direct you to some websites and some other people who you can talk to who can give you clarity around some of these issues. Yes.
I would just like to make one comment about the Mansfield Public Schools. A member of our friends' meeting was very interested in this topic and did approach them at the very beginning. Jen, you know her, and you know, was assured that the school would do all it could to make the waivers readily available and all that. I signed one, and my son was getting calls from a recruiter at home. So, I don't know.
Which doesn't necessarily mean, the waiver does not say no military recruiter will contact my children. What it says is we won't release your records. My records were not released back far enough when I was in high school, but I got calls all the time from military recruiters. I actually had to go through personal testimonial. I actually had to go through four branches of the military, and each time saying, oh, really, I'm a Quaker. I respect your thoughts on life, but really, I'm a Quaker. I'm never going to join the military. I had to do that with each one of those recruiters before they finally left me alone. So it doesn't necessarily have to do with that information having been released. So anyway, that's having addressed that issue. Thank you for bringing that up.
I just want to make one more comment the high school sending names out to recruiters. The CCLU Eastern Connecticut chapter has a model for what high schools can use in terms of dealing with that. Mm. And I think it's a model that we used at E.O. Smith. And I think I'm correct on this, Jen, in saying that at E.O. Smith, you have to send in your permission to have your name sent to the recruiter.
That's right.
It doesn't work the other way around. You don't say, you don't hand in a waiver saying that you don't want them to do it. If you want your child's name sent to the recruiter, you sign a letter saying that you want the child's name sent. Otherwise, it doesn't get sent.
That's a change in policy.
It is. Mm-hmm. It's something that we put into place. It wasn't initially like that. But that's the option that all high schools have, is to set something up like that. It is in your control.
And that's something, one of the reasons I love taking feedback from the group like this is that, you know, I don't live in Connecticut and I don't know about these local victories. That's really important. And this is the way that certainly American Friends Service Committee would prefer it to be. In other words, that consent should not be assumed, consent should be requested. And then if people want to receive information from a military recruiter, again, you know, God bless them. Great. Let them do that. But that's something that, like anything else, a person would have to request. Hopefully, and when we look at that, that's important because of privacy issues. It's important because certainly of our conscience. And it's also important because it's a waste of money, certainly, if people are going to be, you know, soliciting people who aren't interested in doing these things. And it is our money, you know, just to reemphasize the fact that these budgets, these recruiters, every time somebody gets a call, it's our money. So, great. Thank you. I appreciate that insight. What is conscientious objection? Somebody want to raise your hand? For those people who, I'm sure there are an enormous number of people who know exactly what conscientious objection is, but just in case there are people who don't. Do we have somebody who feels compelled to define that for us? Yes.
I was of draft age during the Vietnam era. Conscientious objection, as defined in those days at least, meant you objected to all wars. You couldn't object to a specific war. You had to have some kind of moral, religious justification that you could point to. My personal experience was the same as Michael Moore's. I applied for conscientious objector status. I was turned down. If you were not a member of a traditional peace church, it was much harder to make that case. And then they instituted the lottery, and you know, Michael and I both got numbers way over 300. So. It became a moot point.
Okay. Thank you. So conscientious objection, just in a nutshell, this is an inability based on conscience, based on belief, based on religion or belief or conscience, an inability to engage in war, in some war, in all war. There have been different definitions of that. That's important legally for a number of reasons. Whether a person is opposed to war on the basis of religion. There have been in the past some confusions about whether a person is opposed based on religion or based on values or morality. Atheists have had a very, very hard time being conscientious objectors because they haven't been able to prove that it's a spiritual thing, which calls into question some concerns about separation of church and state. Yes.
I got my CO classification during the Vietnam War.
and I was not a member of a particular church at the time. And I got very good advice going in, which was that based on the advice, you're given a form to fill out, with a series of questions. And rather than fill out the form and answer on the limited number of lines, I wrote an essay, 10,000 words, and each paragraph addressed each particular question. And the beginning phrase of every paragraph in that essay began, "Based on my religious training and belief." And it's the formulation of your conscientious beliefs that are cultivated through a lifetime of experiences, whether it's going through church or however you live, that puts your philosophy at odds with military or combat or violence as a solution to any kind of conflict. And that's the initial part of it. And then there's the draft board, local draft board, calls you in for an interview. And it's set up in a very sophisticated way. They start off and they go around the table. All the members of the draft board ask you very simple and welcoming questions. And then they hit you with a hard question. They will set up a hypothetical situation. Suppose you're in your living room and a mass murderer comes in with an axe. What are you going to do? And they rely on people becoming flustered and emotional at that point and reacting to the visceral situation rather than answering it the only possible way anybody could ever answer it is, "I have no idea. I don't know what I would do. I know that what my belief is that we try to survive and we try to get out of this situation without any violence at all. But I can't tell you what I would do because I don't know." And it's that kind of situation. And every experience for a conscientious objector is an individual situation because the people around that board are human beings. They're people. And the day that I had my interview for the classification, it was a cold morning. It was Southern California, and I wore a jacket that was far too light for the weather, and that put me in good stead because I was kind of nervous and all of that. And just before I came in, there was a kid that had just been interviewed, and he was in a rage. And he was flying out of that office, and he was knocking papers off the shelves, and all of this. And I thought, boy, are they going to be glad to see me. And the difference between me and him, who knows? Because his beliefs may have been as genuine as mine were, but because he didn't have the ability to express it in a way that they found acceptable. He was off to Vietnam and I'm sitting home. So it's. But the key phrase for anybody applying is based on my religious training and belief. That was the legal language at the time.
Thank you for that experience. That really speaks to me, and I think it may speak to other people in the room. Yes.
I was in the military in the 60s. And one of the things that I know about CO status in the 60s was that it depended somewhat on where your draft board was.
Absolutely.
If they were not having difficulty meeting their quotas, that is finding people that they could send off to the military, it was much easier to get CO status than if they were short. If they were having difficulty getting enough young men to meet the quotas that they were given, then it was much harder to get CO status. So one of the things, if you want CO status, is figure out where you're having less trouble and move there.
And this is an interesting point, because we're talking about conscientious objection. We're talking about people who cannot serve on the basis of conscience or religious belief. This doesn't necessarily help those of us who are opposed to war and the conduct and the violence that happens. For me, and this is just my personal belief, I have a very hard time with the idea
that someone would go in my place.
Yes. Yeah.
The problem for me is the war, mm-hmm. not me. I mean, obviously, I, like any other person, I don't want to die in a very horrible way. I also don't want to make anyone else die in a horrible way, whether that person is called the enemy or that person is called another, on my side. That's not where I come from. That's not what my faith tells me. That's not my experience of the message of God in the world. But there are people who are just very clear that they cannot have anything to do with that. It raises an issue. We hear a lot of times with people, the conscientious objectors are cowards. Or we hear that, oh no, these people disagree on religious beliefs. Those Amish and those Quakers and those Mennonites and those Brethren, they're okay. Those Jehovah's Witnesses, they're all right. But these guys over here, they enlisted. And now they want out because there's a war. They must just be cowards. What are people's reactions to that? Let's not talk about these people who I think a lot of us can understand the message of this deeply held lifelong belief that we can articulate. What about these other people? What about people who are in the military, who even volunteer, who sign up with the recruiters, and then they're getting ready to go to the military, or they're people who say, I have, like a friend of mine who I was on the phone with, his name's Eric, he's a Gulf War I veteran, and he just walked across all of New England pushing a 2-ton stone because he feels like he has to atone for all that he did in the Gulf War. He's a Marine, ex-Marine. What about these people? What are the reactions that raises for folks? Yes?
I would offer that the military experience changes you. And you don't really understand what war is until you're actually forced to think about it as I'm about to be shipped out. And I will actually be there. I went a little further. I think if I were to apply again for conscientious objector status, I would be opposed to any service in the military. Because I'm a Unitarian, and we believe in the inherent worth and dignity of each individual. And one of the things that military training does is remove that individuality, because you need to be a functioning member of a team and accept orders without question. And so my service in the military changed my opinion of what the military is.
Other reactions to that? Voices we haven't heard yet.
First of all, I am just so infuriated that recruiters can go into high schools like that and start talking to freshmen. I mean, these are young people. But I'm reminded of a time when it was in the early 80s, and I was in Florida, and there was a mall there, and there was a big recruitment push on for, I forget what reason, and they had brought tanks, big, huge tanks, and driven them into the center of the mall, and they had some other military things around, and I remember standing there and watching people walk by because I was waiting for a friend to join me. And it gradually dawned on me what was happening. The young people were walking by and they were like cool and, you know, looking at this thing up and down. And the old men were walking by and you could tell they had been in a war. And their faces and their whole bodies, they were like looking at this thing and walking around it like it was going to bite them. He's right. When you don't know what war is, it's very different. And in Mother Jones recently, there was an article about Iraqi veterans who are protesting the war and against the war. And one man said that he will not go back. He refuses to serve again because part of his service was he had to be at a checkpoint. And he was told to hold up his hand. And if Iraqis drove through, he was to shoot them. He said, we must have killed 30 Iraqis that day. And we found out later that in Iraq, holding up your hand like this is a sign of welcome. No clue. I mean, they were given no clue about this. How can our government do this? It's just outrageous that...
This is a magazine called Peace Work, which is put out by the American Friends Service Committee. It's a national magazine. It's produced in Cambridge at our regional office. There's an article this month, the November 2004 issue on the Iraq Veterans Against the War, the formation of which was formally announced at the Republican National Convention this year.
Right next to a great article, Will There Be a Draft, by a good friend of mine. So if anyone wants them, I have copies for people to take as they leave. I really appreciate those insights. And that's what I've heard over and over again from young people, men and women. I had a great opportunity. I was at the Republican convention this year to spend some time with Iraq veterans against the war. And the stories that they have to tell are really... The disclaimer that I should have made at the beginning is I don't know anything about military service because I've never been in the military and I've never been put in that position. But they do, and to hear these stories from these people who've served in the military, veterans who are now conscientious objectors, is really humbling and is really powerful. And I would suggest that anybody who hasn't ever talked with a veteran opposed to war do that, because it's really an incredible, instructive experience. So the point that I hope that I can make about conscientious objection is there are lots of ways that we can, and I'll talk about this just before we leave this topic, there are lots of ways that we can prepare ourselves for the possibility that there will be a draft. You know, prepare ourselves spiritually, prepare ourselves morally, and prepare ourselves in terms of getting our stuff together, and I'll talk about that in just a second. But the deeper issue that I would invite everyone to consider is what else are we obliged to do? Not just necessarily to prevent our children from joining the military, because the situation that we have now is that in the policy of the United States, in the foreign policy of the United States, it isn't, as I look around the room, my guess is that it's mostly not our children who are doing the fighting. It's the children of people who aren't in this room. Those are the children who are doing the fighting. That, in many ways, people have talked about a divide in this country. That's a divide to look at. People whose children are dying in Iraq need to be acknowledged and need to be cared for, because those people. I had a chance to cry with a woman whose son died in Northeast Massachusetts. I was with the Eyes Wide Open exhibit. This is exhibited on the cost of the Iraq War. I was in the town where her son was buried the day he was buried, and she saw the exhibit on the news and she came down the stairs and she said, "My son is the Marine they buried today, so I guess I belong here with all these boots." And there's just absolutely no words to express that experience. These are the people we need to reach out to if we want to heal the divisions in this country. There's a hand back there.
It sounds to me that the conscientious objection isn't going to answer the problem. It sounds like the problem is stopping the wars. And stopping war, but how do we go about doing that? We've gone on marches, we've written letters, nobody's listening. Mm-hmm. So it's like, how do you do that? What else can we do? I mean, the democracy isn't working.
Thank you for raising that point, and I hope that I get the sense that that's sort of what's hanging over the whole room, and I really appreciate your giving a voice to it. I would like to, not that I don't want to talk about it, because I certainly do, but I would invite us to talk about, as we move down toward the bottom, my hope is that we would get closer and closer to more effective, more productive things that we can do as we move on from conscientious objection. And I really appreciate your saying that there are things that conscientious objection is not going to fix. Obviously, if everyone was a conscientious objector, there would be no war. The fact that everyone is not a conscientious objector leads us to have to consider who are the people who can get out of it and who are the people who can't. That's something we need to work with. Yes.
Just two thoughts before we leave this topic. I forgot to mention that at least during the Vietnam era, there were two classifications of conscientious objector. One was you objected to war and any participation in the military. So if you were drafted, you needed to do alternative service, and you might have some kind of job in a hospital or, you know, some social service job domestically. The other classification was I object to carrying a weapon, you know, participating in the military in that way, but I'm willing to serve in the military if it's in a non-combat role, and a lot of those people became medics and that sort of thing. The question I have is about a year or two ago, I heard that, I think it's true that the whole selective service machinery is all set up, ready to go, it's just not operating. And that includes the fact that there are local draft boards in every town. Mm-hmm. Many of them have vacancies, and I understand there was a movement to get, you know, Quakers to serve on their local draft boards. I wonder if you heard anything about that.
Sure.
That's got a lot of contradictions in it.
There absolutely is. Well, to begin with, yes, absolutely. People have had different definitions of conscientious objection. Mohandas Gandhi, for example, served as an ambulance driver, organized a unit of ambulance drivers when he was living in South Africa during, I think it was the Boer War. That was his decision about what he had to do, since he knew that his fellow people were going to serve in the war. And I think he also wanted to improve the image of Indian South Africans in people's esteem. So, you know, that was the decision for a lot of reasons. But definitely there have been people who have gone to war who've said, I can't opt out of this, but I'm not going to kill. And then there are people who feel that any participation at all in the machine of militarism is contrary to their conscience. In terms of draft boards, and again, maybe we should redo this training, because that came up. I was going to look at it down here, but let's look at it here. There are local draft boards, and then there are district draft boards of appeals. I actually had a chance, I guess 2 weeks ago, to spend some time with a man who's a Quaker, who has been on a draft board for something like 20 years. He's now on the district board of appeals, and he does this service, this absolutely thankless bureaucratic service, just in case there were to be a draft. He was the chair of the Board of Appeals. So that meant that if anyone came through his board, he would say, conscientious objection? Okay, right? This is a possibility. This is important. To serve on a draft board, you cannot be a member of the military. As a matter of fact, you can't even be a former member of the military. Okay? This has to be, and I think it was well set up in that way, this has to be a civilian thing. Because of that, everyone has a right to serve, regardless of whether or not you're a Quaker, or a Mennonite, or you're Amish, or a Buddhist, or Sikh, or whatever. It doesn't matter. You can serve on a draft board, provided that they can prove that you don't have a record of felony conviction or something like that, which, of course, excludes a whole bunch of people, but that's a subject for another night. Yes?
This brings another problem, though. This administration is different than anything that's ever happened in the United States before. I don't know that the rules and the laws that were before will be followed. I don't know that the draft boards won't be made up of already pre-selected people. That's what's scary here. That's what's extra scary.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's sort of a... just very briefly to address that, there's sort of a good faith effort that we have to operate in. I think we do sort of every day. We assume that most things will work unless they don't. So, you know, we know this is the system that exists now. The best we can do is try to engage the system as it exists, I guess. But I definitely hear that concern.
Two things. In response to you, you know, War Resisters League has been around since at least 1917. It's not a part-time thing. It's going to keep on going. It's not going to be resolved in our lifetime, but you just can't give up. I don't know whether this fits into the category of conscientious objection, but it is an amusing story that gets somewhat at the point of the necessary things for conscientious objection. A friend of mine was called during the Vietnam War to the draft and to take the test and so on and so forth. And I did talk to him about monomania, which most people consider a form of mental disequilibrium, and that if he practiced monomania, he might not go to the service. His monomania was that he could not engage in war and he could not kill. He didn't say anything else. He didn't write anything else. He did that for an hour, never filled out the paper, wrote his name, nothing else. At the end of it, they sent him to a doctor, and the doctor told him to go home.
But the tricky part will be if the military has your whole file all through high school, they'll know that something must have happened to you to say that. And then will it be the help of people like us in this act or not? In other words, they're going to have... It's the whole totalitarian computer regime that I worry about.
And this raises another issue when it comes to service in the military, when it comes to service. Are we objecting based on conscience? Are we working to change the whole system? Are we just trying to get out?
And that's
all free.
I wouldn't suggest that people who are just trying to get out are doing something wrong. I happen to believe that a physical inability to do something might have something to do with conscience, or might have something to do with one's being, not being able to do it. And at the same time, some people might feel differently.